Blog Talk Radio.
For young women who don't consider themselves feminine, babies, please, for the love of all that is holy and right and grandmotherly in this world, stop saying that shit out loud. It makes you sound like an idiot. It's like giving up the first 20 rungs on the ladder to getting some respect. The ladder is like 1,000 rungs tall. You're going to have to ask for every one. You're going to have to full torso fight for every goddamn rung. When you say, I just don't consider myself a feminist, it's like saying, I'm not that crazy about having the right to vote or get an education or prosecute men who perpetrate violence against me. It's like saying, it's cool if my body's property. Also, if you could, please stop following it up with, I've just never been discriminated against personally. Repressed ambition stirring nauseously inside of you, the peace of Eve's apple that won't digest, the slow monstering of you when you have to remind yourself to smile and be nice. The tiger hinging on its hind leg. Don't be grateful. Be ungrateful. Be on your last nerve. Get ready.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Fire Talk. This is Mary Grabiel sitting in with producer Nell Cole today, and the woman you just heard speaking was Mindy Netefi. Mindy is a writer, an accomplished performance poet, as you just heard. She is also the author of two full-length collections. One is Sleepyhead Assassins, and another entitled Rise of the Trustfall. She also has her first collection of essays coming out this fall from Right Bloody, titled Glitter in the Blood, A Poet's Manifesto for Better, Braver Writing. Love that. Mindy also blogs and has her books and upcoming shows that can all be found on her website, which is called thecultofmindy.com. And without further ado, I'd like to welcome producer Nell Cole and Mindy Netefi. Thanks for coming today.
Welcome.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's going to
be
such a fun show.
Yeah, so I love that piece, Mindy, and if you wouldn't mind, just give our audience a little bit more background about yourself and your motivation to write and maybe something more about that piece. What made you write that piece?
Yeah,
let's just start there. Last year, decided to put together a show and a tour with another poet named Rachel McKibbins, who I'd known for a really long time, but we had since parted, and she was living in New York, and I was living in L.A., and but we decided to put this show together for a lot of reasons, partly because we saw a lot of touring groups of poetry that were out there reaching the colleges were mostly men, and although there were a handful of women holding it down, of course. And there was also, we felt, a missing message that wasn't being really addressed in the national poetry community and just in the community in general, which certainly had to do with feminism and its tenets and its history and its meaning, something to do with an environment of, let's be polite and just call it casual sexism, that existed everywhere we went, in addition to some more horrific things about actual violence against men and women in communities happening. And so we decided to really put together a show. We called it The Last Nerve, A High Tea Poetry Brawl, and we actually set up a high tea on stage with tea and teacups and me and my Casio, and we needed, I decided we really needed an opening piece that established from the beginning of the show what our intentions were, what our, you know, sort of just the beginning of our message. And I sat down and wrote that piece 2 weeks, just 2 weeks earlier. I had had a conversation with a young woman, bless her soul, who was 22 years old, who asked me if I was a feminist. And I said, well, yes. And she said, well, I don't really consider myself a feminist. And we talked about it a little bit, and it was the genesis of the piece that I felt like I had had that conversation so many times, even back when I was a younger woman and sort of first going through my feminist awakening. And there was certainly a period in which I was uncomfortable calling myself a feminist, partly because of my distrust in general of political movements or the search for political power. I was unsure as I was just feeling my way through that, and so my path to sort of claiming being a feminist went through various stages, and I, for a long time, I really only called myself a feminist out of respect for the women who had come before me and had fought and been abused and had done prison time and had really, really struggled so that I might be able to live this incredible life with, even with its challenges, I have freedoms that my mother did not, and her mother, certainly her mother did not, and her mother before
exactly.
her. And so I wanted to first address in the piece my real just irritation with this ongoing, I felt slippage, this backslide in American culture that I was witnessing amongst women of my own age group, and then as I got older, just continued to seem to get worse, of women who felt like feminism was a dirty word and they didn't want to claim it. And so it's definitely the first part of the piece is me exploring my rage and irritation about that and trying to, through those emotions, offer a piece of education about where I'm coming from on that. And then the second part of the piece after the turn where I sort of apologize and say, you know, of course you're not ready to call yourself a feminist. I'm barely ready, where I then own the fact that call yourself what you want, our struggles as humans are very real and very delicate, and we're all coming from this place of even as that maybe at the center of it is the vulnerability that comes from being dehumanized into an object from such a very young age, and sort of coming right out of that at the end and saying, having at first sort of shied at everyone into being grateful for the women that came before them and showing some respect and calling them feminists, making sort of a full circle at the end and saying, you know what? Don't be grateful, be ungrateful, because what we need is to recognize how much work there still is to be done and to be ready to claim finally some real anger and rage about that, how far we still have to go, and then use that anger and rage to fuel us, this new generation, to really pick up the fight and move it forward. And keep pushing and teaching our younger sons and daughters and to really finally end our long-standing arranged marriage to silence and start really putting the message out there in a very conscious way. So that was really where I was coming from on the piece. And I definitely occasionally get confronted by young women after shows in many different ways. Some of them come up to me crying, saying, that poem was for me. I didn't know. I've never called myself a feminist. I didn't know, you know, and they're very emotional about it. And some women come up to me afterwards, young women, and are very defensive about it and say, oh, well, I'm not a feminist. I consider myself a womanist because feminism never did anything for, you know, fill in the blank. Women of color, women of different gender sexual identities, you know. And I always love those conversations. I just
want
them to keep happening. I never mind being challenged about my own biases and premises and engaged in a conversation about, because that's a teachable moment. I mean, let's talk about the first wave and the second wave and what went wrong, you know, and how so many women were dismissed and ridiculed out of the movement. And then what the third wave has done to, you know, the third wave is just all over the place, but it has to be because, you know, it has to be so inclusive now of so many things that spring from this deep root of misogyny in our culture. So, so that's where that piece is coming from.
Yeah.
I've been doing this I was 13 and since I was very young and started doing the National Poetry Slams when I was 18 and did that for 5 years and have been traveling and touring and teaching ever since. And I'm about to have my crucifixion resurrection birthday, as I call it, my 33rd, So we're coming up on a 20-year anniversary here of me being on microphones, becoming, I'm sure, increasingly assertive and disturbing to some people. But I also believe more powerful and inspiring as each year goes on. So,
when I watched the video, I was just so happy to see someone of your age understand what it really is. Because there is a disconnect, 40 and below, and maybe somewhat into the mid-40s, of what the movement was and what the true history of it was, and it's been demonized. So, of course, the younger generation has no clue what it was all about. They were born with the rights. So to them, it's not anything that's special because they always had it. Well, they had it on the bloodshed of the generation before them and before them. So when you spoke about it, I was like, hell yeah, finally somebody gets it. Because I had a conversation about a month ago with a girl around 30 years old, and I thought she knew. And I was speaking to her, you know, like she would get it because I thought she would. Not a clue about it whatsoever. And I'm looking like, oh, my God, your generation doesn't know.
Yeah, yeah, I have to say that kind of shocks me, too. I never even thought about it in terms of young girls who really are not aware of the history.
Right.
And I didn't realize there was such stigma attached to it. So, Mindy, my question to you is, what would you say, if you could think of any one thing or one scenario, what would you say that you think would touch all women universally, regardless of age, that would open their eyes that there's still a problem?
Well,
Yeah, no pressure.
Yeah, no pressure. That's a perfect question.
No, but I mean,
try
do you think there's a common thread that everyone can relate to, not just the June Cleavers of the world? Or
I do think that what's in common between all of us is has to do with power and and you know, and it's evil twin powerlessness. And that no matter what circumstances you come from, you do face, whether it's explicit or not, whether it's institutionalized misogyny or racism or homophobia or whatever you want to call it, whether you're seeing it or not, you are living in the cloud of its context, and it's affecting you. And we all have our moments of and our process of discovering our own power, of facing our own powerlessness, of then going through a period of, of blaming ourselves for our own powerlessness and then struggling through that. And then what I see is very common, of course, is in young women especially, is that they feel their only option to having power or to prevent themselves from being exploited by the powerful is to exploit themselves, right? Like, if I can't, you know, if you can't beat them, join them, and I'm not going to allow anyone else to exploit me, so I'm going to exploit myself, my own sexuality, my own identity, and in that way, I can at least not feel powerless anymore. And, of course, you know, that's a dangerous position to take as well, self-exploitation. I mean, good Lord, that leads to a lot of other problems along the pathway towards self-compassion and self-love and self-actualization. And if anything, you know, we're so lucky, any of us who have been born into a society where we are not routinely, you know, victimized by government or religious propaganda, and where even though we are, it's not the same as it is in some societies and cultures, and we're sort of, you know, we end up blissfully, I think, being unaware. That's a nice way to put it. I also sometimes get angry and call it willful ignorance.
The bubble,
right? What's really going on? And you know, as we sort of struggle, even in the smallest situations, to have to own our own voice and our own right to have a voice and an opinion, and to use it, whether or not it's somebody serves you you've paid for a meal at a restaurant and they serve you the wrong thing. Some of us have that moment where we're so trained to be polite and nice and to care about other people's feelings, we're actually afraid to point out to the waiter that this is not what we ordered. And from a situation that low, very low stakes, if you're not prepared in those very low-stakes situations to practice asserting your own needs and using your own voice, you're certainly not going to be prepared to stand up for yourself and use your voice when the stakes could not be higher, when perhaps right. you're in a hospital about to give birth and the doctors are threatening to give you, you know, Pitocin and you don't want it, or when something horrible has happened to someone you love and you need to suddenly navigate a bureaucracy or a legal system and the stakes could not be higher. If you have not practiced in all these very small ways in your life, having a voice, right. loving yourself enough to begin to practice using your power in very small ways, you will be very unprepared for how vulnerable you will be in very high-stakes situations. So I would say for a very universal message for all of us is to, when you feel those moments, no matter how small they are, of powerlessness or of being mistreated, to always use those small moments as opportunities to practice.
Right.
Practice makes perfect, you know. We all start having no voice and no words. We all start that way. And so the journey to having a powerful voice and something to say begins everywhere. And obviously, of course, you know, education is incredibly important. But if you can even just learn to really be grounded in moments when you're being not treated well, and learn to speak up for yourself no matter how small, and not in an aggressive or hostile way, but in an assertive way, not a passive-aggressive way. Those each small choice you make to do that is going to make you stronger and lead you in this path towards self-actualization, political efficacy, you know, power, and a real readiness to face the incredible challenges that we have facing us all over the world right now. So,
yeah, that's what I was just thinking about. I mean, we're sitting here having a conversation about women in the Western world struggling with
mm-hmm.
being assertive, but think about other countries where
right.
you know,
mm-hmm.
they're not even in their infancy of women's
mm-hmm.
rights at this point. So it's really a huge global issue.
Yeah,
yes. Definitely.
Yeah. I was watching a show about the women in India. And, you know, just the phrase of if my husband cheats with me, it's because I wasn't a good wife. Just something
right.
So something like that. It's our
mm-hmm.
self-worth. It's even declaring our boundaries, our just basic boundaries within our daily life is a complex thing
yeah.
for some people.
Yeah, it can
yeah,
be seven
cultural,
levels.
Those cultural norms are really powerful. So I don't know how they'll ever break free from that, but hopefully you know, with the internet and people rising
yeah.
up in other places, the message
well,
will
yeah.
get to them.
And we start with ourselves and we start being examples. You start taking ownership of your own actual responsibility in this world to give. Am I allowed to curse on this show?
Absolutely.
Hell yeah.
Your own responsibility to give a shit and to, you know, really resolve to never be a bystander, not just to violence, but to general bullshit when you see it.
Right.
Resolve to never be a bystander to that, because it's always easier to rise to someone else's defense than it is your own. So if you can even just start there, right, and then learn how to do it for yourself, right? And then, you know, we need to take responsibility for the fact that we need to be examples. All you can do is you, right? All you can change is you. And then
right.
openly, you know, really intentionally be an example of what it looks like to have mental health and speak your mind and to be loving and compassionate. And I say this all the time to myself every day and to other people that, how you do anything is how you do everything.
Right.
And
love that.
How you cook, how you make your soup, and how you brush your teeth, and how you say hello to your neighbor. How you, you know, this has everything to do with also how you do the bigger things in life. So I'm sure some crazy yogi sometimes said that to me somewhere, and it stuck, right? And
yeah.
I just thought, oh, man, what a powerful idea.
It is a powerful idea. It's in the details. But what
mm-hmm.
I do want to do, though, is still honor the movement itself, even though
mm-hmm.
now we're more in the middle mainstream of it. And anytime you do that, you start getting all this stuff. But the people who started it and fought were fighting for the most basic things, and they had
mm-hmm.
no choice. It was life or death. Where now we
Absolutely.
Sit and we can think about, well, what's this and that? Where before it was complete quality of life. And
yeah.
I don't want to dismiss what they did in any way.
Absolutely not. And there's still, it is still very much, we're still very much fighting for basic
yeah.
human rights. To not
even
be
domestic
tortured.
Violence,
right?
all those different
right?
things, it's a pretty new concept of people going to jail and the different things. Like I've had abuse survivors where their early childhood, it wasn't even really mm-hmm. against the law for them to be beat to that
yep.
level.
Right.
It was what happens in the home is that business. So people don't realize how new these laws really are in the scope
yeah,
of things.
Yeah, it's only been a generation or two since things have changed.
Well, and God bless you if you have never had to file a restraining order or help someone
right.
else file a restraining order. But even the legal tools we have now at our disposal are so
Still, yeah.
difficult to use and to uphold. And you may have that piece of paper and call the police, and they may still not be interested in helping you. And the system is really set up only barely to punish after the fact. There's
right.
very little in the way of preventing horrific things from happening in the first place. So I still read, you know, Eleanor Roosevelt and Abigail Adams, and I still read my foremothers in this country, and in addition to the feminists that came after, and, you know, bell hooks, and I always am trying to reground myself because the struggle has not really changed that much. And I always feel like I should admit this to everyone that I did work for Hillary Clinton's campaign. And I really credit that year that though it was in the end, the feeling when Barack Obama won and so quickly, I mean, ugh. Amazing, but that year, that election, right, the fight between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton for the nomination
mm-hmm.
was what I call, in retrospect, my awakening to my repressed ambition, and not a personal ambition, but my ambition on behalf of women. I didn't know how badly I wanted a woman to be president. I didn't know until it was suddenly almost possible.
Right.
And suddenly it meant so much to me. And it also meant so much to me to see a man of color. I mean, so it was a very emotional year.
I know.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. And then Proposition 8 passed in California, and suddenly gays who'd been allowed to be married weren't. And I just felt like I was riding this roller coaster of the emotional spectrum and really learning about how all this politics that I thought was so far removed from me for so long, right? You think what happens in the federal government or internationally, right, it has nothing to do with you, and how wrong I was, that year was just a very powerful year for me, its lessons are still very much with me, and you know, I'll just never forget the feeling of me suddenly understanding that the reason I hadn't even allowed myself to want it because I never thought I was going to have it.
Right.
I never thought
it wasn't
I'd ever
even
see
on the table.
Power.
Yeah.
So I just decided not to want it because how else do you survive and find joy? You start letting go of these things you believe you can never have, and then to believe to have the hope for even a minute, you know,
yep.
And then to have at least one of those hopes realized. When Barack Obama won, I mean, it was just after the trauma. We're calling it that, ladies. We're calling it trauma. The trauma of the 8 years of George W. Bush in office.
Oh, God. Yes.
The paralyzing grief of those 8 years. It was a really healing experience.
For anybody at that point.
At least
I didn't
briefly,
care.
Right?
Yeah. Anybody.
And then we got hit by the economic apocalypse.
Yeah.
But, you know, for a moment we got to live in the light, you know.
Yeah.
Oh.
But George Bush was the greatest teacher for me of so many things. All lessons that I had no desire to learn, but had no choice. But I will never forget the lessons I learned from how dark it can get.
Amen.
And
amen.
I don't know if I'll ever recover from that whole thing.
Nope.
Well, I agree with you that that lesson.
I call it a aftermath math. You know,
yeah.
We're never, it's still just continuing, you know, and it's an exponential equation. Those decisions that man made and the coup that put him in office in the first place.
Oh, yeah.
And then the devastation of him winning the second election.
Oh, I know.
You know, where we're suddenly all going, you know what, maybe this is the result of democracy. Maybe this really is. Maybe I need to rethink some of my basic assumptions. Good Lord, it was.
I know, it made you rethink every nuance of everything because his decisions touched everything in a negative way. And now
he did,
like,
and not everybody was a fan of Bill Clinton. I thought he was great, but he wasn't perfect. He did some things that were wrong too, but he did so much for just the environment and conservation. And Bush turned around and pretty much reversed every freaking law that he passed. Just such a landslide and such a struggle for the environmental community to try to rebuild what Bush took away.
Right?
But I agree with you about that election in 2008 with both Hillary and Obama running. That was the real game changer. You know, that movie came out with Sarah Palin called Game Change. The real game change was the fact that we had a woman and an African American man on the ticket,
exactly,
running for the highest
and I thought, if anything, I thought, wow, well, you know, I was almost looking forward to it. I thought all the you know, hidden, secret, institutionalized, veiled racism is not going to be so veiled anymore.
Right.
I was kind of just waiting for it. Let's just see how it's going to rear its ugly head now, because it's time for it to just come out and show its face for what
it
really is.
Yeah.
And
well,
it did, and it continued. It's still continuing to show itself.
Oh my gosh. I mean, you know, it has its spokespeople in, you know, not only some of the men running for the Republican ticket right now, of course, but you know, our ongoing great teacher, that is Rush Limbaugh, in all things bullshit. Good Lord. I mean, ladies, let's take a moment of silence and appreciation for Rachel Maddow.
Oh, yeah.
You're here.
Man, is she giving, you know, whether they're paying attention or not, she is showing up with a real education for all of us on the daily.
She really is.
Really appreciate her voice in our media culture.
She knows her stuff, right? People may label her with that feminist term that some people think there's a stigma attached with.
Dirty,
but if you really look at it, she's just one of the best damn journalists we've had in a long time.
Oh yeah. She is smart. She is not afraid. And she's got style. She's got style, you know?
Yes, she does.
And she is such a respectful debater. Another thing I really love about her and have learned and observed watching her is how she she's just so elegant when she confronts people with opposing views and opinions, and while at the same time, you know, cutting them to the quick. And I do believe in democracy. I don't know that we have a real one or anything like that. That's a whole other conversation. But I do believe that, you know, we have a – I don't know about this bipartisan party where we're all supposed to feel good and pretend like we agree about things.
Yeah.
We have legitimate differences of opinion that come from a very, very real difference in values. And we
yeah.
should be allowed to duke it out in as respectful a manner as possible, of course, with statesmanship. But, you know, that's what we should be doing. We shouldn't be seeking some lukewarm, incrementalist middle ground. We should be really having these fights. Let's not get me started on my disappointment in Congress. We'll be here
yeah,
for the next.
I think that's the lesson that Obama learned the hard way. But
yep. And so did Hillary for, you know, 8 years. She got taken down by Congress a few times while her husband was
yeah.
in office.
Uh-huh.
And Obama then had to also learn those lessons, you know, about how politics gets played, regardless of how, you know, you're trying to follow the rules and be a good man. I caught some clips from his work at the White House Correspondents' Dinner,
mm-hmm.
Where he made my favorite, well, he made a couple of favorite jokes, but my favorite one was at the very end where he says, I had some more material here, but I need to get home because of his guards. Right, right. They have a new curfew. They have a new curfew. He made a joke about that. And I appreciated that joke because
yeah.
I appreciated Barack Obama's response to that, that he was so obviously livid with their behavior. And I thought, you know, say what you want about Barack Obama. He is himself 100% of the time. There is no, you know, he's the opposite of Mitt Romney. He's not hiding or, you know, he really is himself, and I may disagree with him on some policy points and tactics, but I appreciate that that he was genuinely livid with his Secret Service after that debacle.
Yeah, like they're the first white men to go to other countries and do stuff. I mean,
right.
The things that these corporate people do in other countries is mind blowing, and yet we're worried about this.
I say first term because I fully expect him to have a second term, but his
Amen.
First term sort of reminds me of that scene from Joe Pesci and My Cousin Vinny where he's like, is there
oh,
any
God.
More shit that we could possibly pile on top of this? Like, oh, yes. And now the Secret Service. Oh, girl.
Could it get worse? Yes, it can. Short answer. Oh, man.
Well, let's talk of your writing, and let's
okay.
hear a little more about your work, if you don't mind, because I'd
not
like
at all,
to hear about what it takes to write all these things and the mindset and
okay.
all and the background of it. Can you kind of just tell us a little more about where you pull all these different things from? Or
I just finished writing this book that's coming out in this fall that's exactly this topic, which I was commissioned to write a book on writing poetry, sort of a how-to book. And
mm-hmm.
I only agreed to do it because it scared the crap out of me. I thought, you know, oh, my God, like, I'm so young still. What in the world do I have to say on this subject? And it made me feel like a fraud to be sort of coming out with this how-to book on writing poetry. And then I thought, you know, it took me a while to figure this out, that what I was uncomfortable with was this doctor-patient dynamic about something that is so deeply sacred to me that I don't feel like I could come out and tell someone else. That'd be like me writing a book telling you how to pray or how to make
right.
your breakfast or how to clean your house or how to raise your children. So I approached it as simply, I thought, well, what I can do is reveal to other people what my process is and how
right.
that came about. I can show you how I do what I do. If anything, I would say that the number two things that are the best advice you'll ever get on writing and how to write and where to begin on all that is, read, like, a lot.
Yeah.
And, you should be reading, like, a lot. If you're trying to be a poet, you certainly should be reading a lot of poetry, but you should be reading nonfiction. You should be reading The Atlantic Monthly. You should be reading The New York. You should really be reading. And the more you read, the more you will develop your ear for language. And also, it will help you find those poems are so good that you love so much. Just reading them makes you want to quit forever. You're like, this person just said exactly what I've always been trying to say, 10 times better than I'll ever be able to say it. I give up. And then the moment after you feel that comes the moment when you're inspired to write. So you need to find those things and collect them like talismans. And then the other part you need to do is to write, like, a lot, because there is – I actually don't believe in writer's block. work begets work, Writing begets writing. It is like a muscle, like your heart, and it needs to be used in order for it to work. And like any muscle, you have to work it out. And even if you feel like you have nothing to write about, you should be sitting down going – oh, God, I have nothing to write about. And you should just keep writing that until you burn through that. Because as you start to get, I do a lot of free association. And when I was younger, I had to do a lot of that very literally, sort of on paper and free associating. And now it's just how I see the world. Sometimes I joke that being a poet is a form of brain damage. It has changed how I see everything because I see now connective tissue everywhere, and it informs how I view the world, how I see everything. And so now my free association is happening all the time on the daily, and everything I see and everything I hear and the music I hear and the people I talk to, the stories I hear, and I collect all of it. That's your source material. Anything that's
right.
ever happened to you or anything you've ever read that made you angry or made you laugh or anything you ever saw that caught your eye and you went, what is that? There's also, I talk a lot about the source cup of your own life, which doesn't mean that you should only be writing about, like confessional things about your own life. That's not true. But there are people and writers out there who write about things that they have no connection to at all. They write about wars they have no connection to. They write about poverty when they've been raised with a trust fund. And when that happens, it's not okay. I mean, not only at minimal you get cognitive dissonance, in the reader, but at worst it's just direct emotional manipulation to be using someone else's source material and co-opting it as your own because you don't think that your source material, I guess, is, interesting enough. I mean, if you don't think it's interesting enough, you're not paying close enough attention to your own life.
Right.
Trust me, whatever has happened to you has not happened to anyone else, and even if it has, you do not see it the same way as they do, and you perceive that experience through every other experience that ever happened to you, because people are cumulative. You are cumulative. You are everything, everyone you have ever been. You are, everything you've ever seen, everything you've ever been through, and whether or not you are conscious of that, your brain has stored it.
Absolutely.
And if you start to write and you really engage yourself in that process of writing, these stories will bubble up, or trickle down, however we want to call it, wherever you think your subconscious is located, that's up to you. But it will start to release itself, and it's and amazing things will happen. Amazing things will happen. I write. Because I have to at this point. I may have started writing because because it was the cheapest art form besides humming, and we were very poor. The longer I wrote, I need to always be getting what's inside of me out of me, and it's not always poetry. Sometimes, like all of us, you know, we need to write the letters, you know, the ones we're never going to send, right, because we're really
yes.
upset. Or the letter to ourselves, because we're trying to understand something and articulate something into words that is very confusing and nebulous and painful for us. I think most of us start from a place of emotional confession, or just this need to try to get out, you know, from under our skin these emotions we don't understand.
Yeah.
And then eventually start to embrace it as more of an intellectual exercise. And then hopefully later on that there's an integration of the two, of the emotional process and the play, the word play, right? So that as you're writing, you're engaging all parts of your body and your heart and your mind and your brain and using it to tell story. I mean, I call myself, and this is for no reason at all, but I call my kind of writing narrative philosophical. You know, I'm always trying to tell stories, but I'm also really trying to express ideas, often ones I don't know that I'm trying to express until I'm, like, at the moment of articulation, and it just comes up, you know, and suddenly I go, oh, man. And the reason I know I should keep writing something or start writing about it is that it has an emotional charge for me, and that emotional charge might be the big ones. It might be rage, it might be anger, it might be ecstasy and joy, or it might be just embarrassment, right? It might
yeah.
be these smaller emotional charges that we usually brush off and ignore, but anything that has that emotional charge to it, you need to go there. It has some gems for you.
Mindy, I'd like to thank you for that advice. That is awesome advice for any writer, but I also think for any person, like you mentioned,
yes.
just the personal journaling, you know, just to get your feelings out, whether anyone ever sees it or reads it or not. But I think that's great advice for writers, and I will definitely take that to heart. I have to quote you, though, on something you said.
Okay.
You said, poetry should hammer all the nerves. And that we need to breathe it like clean air. We need it as bad as we need clean air. So I think you just spoke to that, what that means. But in terms of hammering the nerves, do you find yourself, you know, looking to sources to select words or how you're going to put that poem together, or is it just simply, like you said, free-flowing, like it's just coming to you and you're just putting it down?
Well, I am always switching up my process, and it just depends on what the piece is that is at hand. Certainly some things are just, but I am never, I mean, I am very, very close with my good friends, the dictionary and the thesaurus. those are my Bibles, and I very intentionally, you know, am always searching, you know, for the right word, the right word combination, you know, the right rhythm, the right context. And the thing that I am a control freak about is tone. And tone is just really difficult to control, because you can have a very clear intention of yourself about your tone, but if it's printed or out there,
right.
You know, whatever anyone else reads into it or projects onto it, you have no control over that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I do as much as I can when I am writing to, of course, very intentionally choose words that have the sound and the tone that I'm looking to transfer my meaning through. And I often talk about when I'm teaching, too, that it's really important to ground your writing in specific details because true specific details because, like, you can talk about, say, you know, my love for my sister is as complex as a rainforest, and that doesn't, like, we kind of understand what you mean, but we don't really understand. I mean, you know, No one's going to get the ring of truth from that or feel that resonance, whereas if you actually tell some real concrete details about your relationship with your sister, people will laugh hysterically and completely get you, even though that thing never happened to them, you know. If it's grounded in a real detail, it will have the ring of truth. And I mean ring like vibration, you know, like
yes.
the way sound travels, like the way our bodies receive actual energetic information. And that vibration of truth is what will get your tone and your meaning across, so that even someone who's never even had a sister is suddenly is going to be just right there with you at the end of it. You're going to have communicated something to them that is very universal, and they're going to feel it and be there with you, something that is universal about complicated love, the love that we have for anyone who's our family or someone who's like family to us, who we have conflict with, but is not someone who we can cut out of our life.
Right.
So you just got to deal with that conflict, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can put up a boundary. You can talk. You can not talk to them for a few years, but that doesn't mean they're not in your life. You know, those people that are with you always. Anyway, so. Wow, I can't. It's so funny to hear myself quoted sometimes and go, "Yeah, that sounds like me." I don't remember saying that, but I'm sure I did, because I would say something like that. I do believe at this point that, I mean, the great poetry is literally striking nerve endings in you. You are literally experiencing as you read it a real reception of information, and I believe the world needs poetry. Because all we have, you know, it needs music, too. I don't make, in my own mind, there's not a huge distinction, I guess. I believe music is a form of language, but we need to be communicating with each other about the things we have no words for, and the things, at least we don't have words for yet. And we have the tools to do that. It's called metaphor.
Yeah.
You know, it's called symbolism. You know, we can talk about the things that are too big and beyond language through metaphor. And it's so important now more than ever that those of us with any gift at all in the area of communication start intentionally using that gift and giving it to others and helping them, you know, hone their gift, because we need to be understanding each other more, by which I mean sharing meaning. Like when I say a word, I need us, we're not even really speaking the same language if I think the word means one thing and you think it means another.
Yeah.
Wasn't it Malcolm X who said, if you know, in order to speak to a man, you have to speak his language?
Yeah.
And besides the fact that almost all things that were said for so long and continue to be said are always using the he, I still take that as a universal message that it's, yeah, when you speak to any person, you need to speak that person's language. And it's so important to find ways to share, to forge shared meaning with each other, so that we can even begin to have these conversations about what needs to happen, and how to redesign the world. And each time we go to redesign a system that is broken, it's just going to create 20 more problems. And we need to be up to that challenge. So we need to not just be able to communicate so that we can accomplish these tasks. We need to communicate so that we can constantly heal each other from the parade of disappointments that we're always going to be coming up against as we have expectations, and then some of them are met and some of them are not, and as we continue, you know, through this chaotic world to begin to consciously and with, you know, great love and effort, try to change what is so horribly wrong in so many ways, in so many aspects, from whether someone is just doesn't have access to clean water, or someone doesn't have access to health care, or someone's parents never told them that they loved them, or they were born without parents, or, you know, or maybe someone's dog just died, and if they don't have the tools to communicate about that emotion about that grief, you know, not even just for a person but for a pet, if they don't have the words to get it out of themselves and to
yep.
grieve, not just with their bodies and their tears, but with words, that is the beginning of things being swallowed and put into the shadow, and then eventually it's going to come out somewhere, right, in some kind of violence against someone else, whether it's mental violence, emotional violence, whether it's someone just being a total stranger being hostile to you, or it being actual violence, physical violence. You know, what turns, I think about this a lot, where's the beginning of what turns someone into a sociopath? Where does that begin?
Exactly.
Is it, because they're not all, maybe some of them are born that way, maybe, but they certainly not all are born that way. And where is the earliest possible intervention? Where is it? And if I could say one more thing about this, it's something that I have learned from my incredible tour partner I mentioned earlier, Rachel McKibbins, who speaks so eloquently about that we have the power to teach empathy to anyone. And she is a master at teaching empathy through teaching poetry, and specifically the poetic device of personification, of learning to see objects as having the qualities of people. So that when you see the sky is raining, you go, oh, the sky is angry, or the sky is sad, and the way you start to personify the world around you and acknowledge that physical objects are witnesses to everything that is happening, and imagine that they have emotions, and that using this poetic device of personification, that you can teach empathy to, she taught in Bellevue Hospital in New York for a long time with children who were incarcerated there for various reasons of mental illness, different diagnoses, whether they were right or wrong or who knows, and did incredibly powerful healing work with these kids and teenagers, teaching them empathy through personification. And I believe that it's not like an overnight cure. You know, this is not some, I'm gonna, you know, it's not a 3-day weekend of brainwashing.
No, that's a life journey.
It's a life journey. But if you get in there young, and teach children empathy young, that it will change the world.
Absolutely.
That's where we got to begin.
That makes
perfect
sense.
So I do expect to believe poetry is important, and that poets are important. And I didn't always. This was a long journey for me to see the value in what I do. I'm still struggle with it. I feel like it's very selfish sometimes what I do, because I have it's such a pleasure for me, and it's so, you know. It's my passion, and because I get to do what I love, sometimes I have moments where I go, man, is this really selfish of me to be doing this? Should I be applying my vast intelligence instead to solving some other critical problem? And it's a continuing journey for me to acknowledge that what I do and what I teach, and that being a professional inspirer and teacher of empathy and also a professional disarmer of the self and others, of teaching other people how to take down the walls they have built up around themselves to protect themselves, but how to take them down if they want to, so that they can come back out.
There's nothing more powerful in the world than to teach someone how to awaken their soul.
Yeah.
Especially someone who's had their soul kicked every which way it can, by systems and everything, and their life robbed from them, and the clock is ticking, and all they have is somebody to step in and say, you know, let me teach you, let me help you find that person you would have been if those things wouldn't have happened to you before your life clock runs out. And you never got to feel who you really were. the entire time.
Right.
That's I agree. I would not underestimate the empathy value of the spoken word when you're up there performing.
Yeah.
You know, people are living cathartically through that. Or you are awakening things in them with your speech. And you know, maybe you say you sometimes feel like it's selfish or something, but it's really for other people, even though you're speaking your experience. It is
right.
Doing that awakening, and they're feeling that empathy. So I don't sell yourself short on that.
Absolutely. And the thing is the knowledge of vibration that you have,
yes.
You understand how to tap into people's vibrations and how they receive energy. And have you studied how people process information and all those different things?
Oh, have I.
Because I can tell within you that you're actually, in a way, using the person as an instrument. And I can tell that you have knowledge of how to awaken their vibrations. So where did you get these sources from?
Well, I would say primarily two different areas. And one is that both my parents were preachers. Although my mom was mostly in a capacity of being a chaplain or you know, an education program director at a church, my father was a minister, but he came out of the closet when I was 4 years old as a gay man, and then he lost everything. He lost his family. He was shocked when my mother wanted to still divorce him. I mean, you know, bless his heart. But anyway. I was raised in the Christian church, but obviously then had a lot of confusion surrounding religion. So I, in order to heal myself from that, I became very, very interested at a young age in studying all religions. And of course, I went through my Joseph Campbell phase of looking for the commonalities and making those more important. And then the phase of like, well, wait a minute, they're not all the same, actually. What is different? And, you know, and what studying religious systems taught me, if anything else, is just that all systems are just systems, that it's people within them that,
right.
that you know, in any system, whether it's a government bureaucracy or a religious dogma and institution, there are amazing, miraculous, beautiful people, and there are just, you know, unrepentant assholes and sociopaths and dangerous people, and that it's not the system itself necessarily, although systems can, of course, be skewed and gamed one way or the other. But I learned a lot from studying that, and then I became extremely, and am still very, very interested in everything that we know and continue to learn about neuroscience and the body, the science of the
yep.
mind and body. So I've studied, I'm going to call it pop neuroscience, because I certainly can only read things that are written by people who can communicate with someone who doesn't have a PhD in chemistry. One of those women is Candace Pert.
I knew that's where you were going. I was going to say, you've got to be talking about
Candace
Pert.
Yeah, the molecules of emotion. The molecules
yeah.
of emotion were one of the first books that really turned me on to gave me the initial tools to understand how the body works and how neuroscience
works. That's a great
book
that everyone, male or female, should read, because she did
that
work, and the glory kind of got
yeah.
stolen from her from it, but that was her
I
work.
I know. And it's also, I think the reason that book hit me so hard, too, is it's also the story of her early research during the very beginnings of the AIDS crisis. And because I was also raised in the gay community, I was a child in the 80s when, you know, men who should have been living, you know, blossoming, full, vivid lives were rotting
right.
in hospital beds. And I went to many funerals and knew many people that died. And, you know, Reagan and Bush were in office, and they were incredibly callous about, you know, denying funding for the research and, And that really affected me. And I, you know, obviously I, from a very early age, had a huge problem with authority because I felt, I just saw what was happening. And I stopped calling myself a Christian. This is adorable. A little bit, and not also, but right after the Rodney King riots in L.A., when I saw that this church that we went to that was supposed to be this incredibly beautiful liberal church, and it was, and, you know, it was filled with all different kinds of people, and gay men and women and transgender men and women, and a little bit of color. It was in Orange County, so there wasn't a lot of color, but there was some, and they were not interested in doing anything to confront or address or be involved in the aftermath of those riots. And I'd never been more disappointed in good people in my life and asked my mother's permission to not go to church anymore. I just said, I can't do it anymore. I don't believe y'all actually mean what you say ever. And, you know, and she just said, all right, you know, okay. And she knew better by then than to, I was a
child.
And was old enough at that point to be left alone for a few hours on a Sunday morning. I wasn't going to get into too much trouble. So I stopped going to church, but I did keep playing the piano. I'm also a classically trained pianist. And so if I got any discipline, I got it from there. So who knows where I think. So maybe there's a third thing. So maybe I learned what I know from my study of, my intensive study of religion, my intensive study of neuroscience and the body, and then also the fact that I am, that from a very young age, starting at 4 years old, I was taught the piano and was classically trained all the way through my 20s. And that in a very real way, the only place in my life I ever learned real discipline was from these weekly piano lessons. And there's a way in which I understand vibration and that when I'm learning about it and reading about it in neuroscience or in religion, right? When, in many religious texts, they're talking about energy and vibration, that I understand exactly what they mean because I spent so much of my life trying my damnedest to play Beethoven's Pathétique. And literally training my body in the art of creating vibration and listening to it and knowing when it was wrong or when it was right, and that I hardwired myself for it, literally. And maybe all those three things gave me these, you know, kind of join forces to give me the powers I have now of seeing what the vibrations coming off of reading other people very easily. It's not, I'm not psychic. I just have my eyes wide open. You know what I'm saying? And can read someone else from their posture and their tone of voice and their, you know, the vocabulary they're choosing, how they dress. You know, sometimes I just feel like I already know way too much about someone in 5 minutes and I need to walk away.
Well, I love the fact that you've read Candace Bird. I feel so much less nerdy now.
please.
I want to quote something I saw on your website. What's that?
What did you just say?
Oh, I was going to mention something that I saw on your website. It was, had been printed in Bust Magazine, and they said that you are the equivalent of the linguistic orgasm we've all been waiting for. So I want to know if when you're performing, do you feel like you're experiencing a linguistic orgasm?
Oh, I have my moments where I'm pretty sure I'm leading the whole audience in a linguistic orgasm. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I'm also very much a preacher's daughter, and I know a thing or two about building momentum in climaxing.
Yep.
So
there is a
I know how to get the audience there. Mm-hmm. I know how to get it there. To that moment of explosive understanding and joy, you know.
Right.
If that is indeed what I decide the task at hand is. So,
and with being said, I'm going to play one of your creations the first time and let everybody hear that.
Okay.
And then we'll be back after that.
And then we'll wrap
up. And no pun intended, right?
All right. Here's the first time.
Copeland. The quote goes like this: some people think the truth is the worst thing that can happen. The truth is not the worst thing that can happen. Tony Copeland. The first time your heart was torn from your chest, you thought you were dying. You knew you couldn't live with the empty space, so you replaced your heart with metaphor and set out to create a world where the metaphor was unbreakable. Now look what you've done. You can't breathe, so you write. You can't hurt, so you drink rum and pour out pirate shanties. You can't want revenge, so you leave. When I see you, I have two thoughts.
She'll be calling right back, I'm sure. There she is.
So sorry.
Oh, that's all right.
I hit
there?
A button and I'm back
live
now.
From New York. It's Mindy.
All of a sudden, I looked at my switchboard and I'm like, oh, where'd she go?
And she's gone.
And she's gone. That's all right, though. We got you back now. What I was wanting to talk about is people's comfort level with complex emotional things. Like, I know you deal with a lot of things like sex trafficking or different high-level stuff. Like in my network, we have a lot of people who are targets of genocide and heavy, heavy abuse. And how do you stand within that and see all the pieces that most people can't look at because it's too difficult? How do you stand in something like that?
This is what we were talking about the other day when we had our pre-show talk, which is, I have this thing I call, that I consciously build. It's called my layer of love fat. I imagine it as this, like, fluffy marshmallow invisible cloud around me, and I build the love fat by constantly listening to and reading and absorbing good stories, positive stories, you know, about beauty and about nobility and, you know, about some designer that just, you know, invented a new strain of mushroom that is creating a new material that will suddenly, you know, that stuff really uplifts me, and I use that to build my love fat very consciously because it's really important to have that layer of good so that when you're confronted with the darkest possible stories, that's the way that you cannot check out, that you can be present and you can look it in the face and you can listen and really, really hear it and face it. And you can do it by building the love fat, that if you have the good stories in you, they will protect you. And without your need to deflect or hide from it, you will be able to face the darkness if you have consciously built your, you know, filled your cup with the good. And I do a lot of work with survivors of sexual abuse and trauma and sex trafficking and other forms of violence and trauma and abuse. But I do work with a lot of specifically victims of sexual trauma and rape and kidnapping. And many of them, of course, I mean, man, their bodies, just at the beginning, their body, you know, they've got their arms crossed and their whole body is a shield.
Yep.
And they don't want to talk, and they don't want to tell their story, and they don't want to listen to anyone, and they're just fiercely, fiercely protecting themselves. And some of them have, you know, they've coped in whatever way they could to get to the point at which I'm meeting them, and I have nothing but respect for whatever walls they needed to build, whatever coping mechanisms they needed to use just to survive. And I'm there to help them get to the place where they can speak and tell their story and to, you know, with whatever magic tricks I have up my sleeve.
Yeah.
And largely that trick is really not a trick at all. It's just I am very, very casual about talking about my own traumas and abuse, and I demonstrate for them by I go first. I am honest with them, and I tell them my dark stories, and very casually, so that I give permission to them to tell their own darkness to me as casually. Like, we can take this moment and build this space, and in this space we are safe, and we can lower the stakes. We can lower the stakes enough and free ourselves enough in this moment and in this space that we can speak about the horror. And then all I do is listen. I just listen, because what they need is for somebody to listen to their story and not have to hide and not cry. You know, they need someone. I mean, sometimes I do cry, you know, but I don't hide my crying. at all. If I am moved to tears, I am moved to tears. And I look them in the face and I listen and I listen and I listen and I listen and I absorb it. Because they need someone to absorb the blow for them. It just for once in their life, for once in their fucking life, they need someone to absorb that blow. And I can do it because of my marshmallow love fat. And I don't want to know this stuff. I don't want to hear these stories. No one does. No one wants to live through it. No one wants to hear it. We all want to be sitting in our backyard sipping lemonade and petting our poodles and reading delicious short stories. But, you know, the real work at hand and that is demanded of us is to reach out and seek out and create safe spaces for those who have been traumatized and have survived it, and to begin the healing process by simply enabling them to be listened to. And I think, I also just hate to be the bearer of bad news, and I love the folks I know in my life who have been so well loved and had so little trauma in their own lives that they see the world through the rose-colored love glasses. And bless those magical unicorn people, bless them. And I do not want to be the bearer of bad news to them, but I will be the moment I see that it's happening, that they are not recognizing that not all people are noble and that there are real sociopaths and murderers and serial rapists out there, and that this is not a magical world where everyone has the potential to be Mahatma Gandhi, okay? Some people are permanently damaged, maybe from birth, but mostly because of the horrors that were visited upon them, that permanently damaged them, that they are not going to recover from. And those people are not safe, and we need to recognize they are not safe, and we need to make sure they are not welcome, that they know they are not welcome amongst us, that we protect each other from them, that we are aware of their presence the moment they arrive. If the hairs rise up on the back of your neck when someone walks into a room, pay attention. That person is not okay and needs to go. And you need to learn somehow in your life to be the kind of person that can get that person out of the room. And
I'm that kind of person. I see them immediately. And then I not only do I have to fight that person, but I have to fight everyone around that person who defends that person. No, they're a nice person. I know them. And my hairs are, the hairs are rising up, and I'm going like, can you not see? And then you have to spend months fighting the person that you knew from the moment they walked in the door, and you never do convince the network entirely of who that person was. Then forever you have to live with the looks of people sometimes thinking you were the crazy one. And I'm thinking in my mind, do you know how much I just protected you? You have no clue.
And yet, we call that a predators.
Yes.
We call that campaign crazy bitch, you know?
Yes.
That's campaign crazy bitch. When even though you're the one that has stuck your neck out to protect everyone else, suddenly you're the crazy one. You're the one that, you know, and I don't care. People can call me what they want. They can call us what they want, those of us who seek to protect the vulnerable amongst us and who not only seek to protect those vulnerable amongst us and protect those who cannot speak up for themselves, but who are also willing to stand with anyone who is speaking up for themselves, and to use every law and every social contract at our disposal, and if those are not available to us, to use our own bodies to protect others. Because, you know, I know what I see, and I know what I'm feeling, and I know a fake patois when I hear one. I know when someone is not okay, and I'm certainly doing a lot of hard personal work at looking back on my many, many years of where I may not have directly contributed to an environment, you know, but I must have. You look back and you go, man, I've been in communities where horrific things have happened. And in what way did I participate in creating an environment that allowed that to happen? So I've really been looking hard at myself as well very recently and looking back and going, man, how many times did I, instead of confronting a man in front of, or a woman in front of others, pull them aside privately to have the confrontation, sort of believing that that was the best thing to do, when what I should have done was called them out right in front of everybody else and not been afraid of the consequences of that conflict. But, you know, a lot of us start out incredibly conflict-averse for many, many reasons. Maybe because we were raised to be, you know, nice girls or, you know, or that, you know, the most important thing is to protect other people's, you know, understand and be aware of their emotional needs and meet them. And I've only relatively recently come into my own about recognizing that, that if I have to make a choice between protecting someone from what I know is imminent harm and protecting the feelings of the person I'm about to confront, well, that's an easy choice for me to make. And people can see that, you know, they do, of course, they see it in a negative light often, and they call us many terrible names, or they call it a witch hunt, or, you know, as if we are out there wanting to hunt down innocent people.
We have nothing better to do in our lives.
And also, it's just better to stick your neck out and be wrong than to not say anything and let the abuse go on. So, it, you know, there is a risk you take, but it's definitely one that's worth it, because how could you live with yourself knowing that someone might continue suffering because you didn't speak out?
That's been the hardest lesson for me to learn. And the only reason I've gotten to the point now is because I've seen the results of not doing anything. And it's still very hard because it's against my nature to come at someone, because I'm always seeking, you know, a balance. But I've had to get comfortable with it. And women need to get comfortable with confrontation. But not being a full-blown bitch about it. But you need to learn how to fight and stand your ground. And when people are spinning the truth, you need to learn how to unspin it and stand in your truth.
Get out there and read The Art of War. Study it.
Yes.
Great book. And, you know and prepare yourself for real conflict and be ready for it, because the world needs fierce matriarchs. The world needs strong, vocal, unafraid women to get out there and be the lionesses that we are. And be willing to stick our necks out regardless of consequences to us or our own comfort level, because we're going to be all right. We're going to survive whatever embarrassment or whatever. You know, I mean, please, that will be processed and dealt with and forgiven and moved on from quickly. And what will not be processed through quickly and gotten over with quickly is what I call the greatest regret hits, right? Where you look back and go, I am not one of those no regrets people. I really believe in having regrets. Like getting to know your regrets very well, understanding why you have them, and looking back and really learning the lessons that they taught you about what you, you know, revisiting those moments when you could have made a different choice but didn't.
Yes.
And then the consequences that followed, the aftermath math, and, you know, follow that back to that first choice you made. And I'm sure that, you know, we are all doing the best we can with the information we have at the time. We're doing the best we can, but that doesn't mean you forgive yourself to the point of forgetting the mistakes that you've made, and that you let those regrets guide you in your future attempts to be a better, radder human being who is unafraid to face the darkness, and also to lose your mind sometimes with rage and grief, knowing it's okay. Lose your mind. It will come back to you.
yeah. Yeah, that regret is what gives you the strength next time to stand your ground and not back down, because
that's right.
You don't want to relive it. So it becomes part of your weapon to help
Absolutely.
You have the strength. So, but it's definitely, you know, every time I listen to you, I think about like a show topic every 5 seconds that we should be talking about. And I'm going,
I know,
like, oh,
we're running out of time.
I know, and I'm
like, my to-do list has like 54 things on it now.
I know, it's just unbelievable. But the biggest thing that I just realized is we train, like, we take self-defense classes and we kick bags and we feel all tough. But where do we verbally learn to do combat, to protect ourselves?
Where does that self-defense begin? Yes.
Yeah, where is that class at? Where we learn how to verbally defend ourselves in this polite society.
Yeah, well, it's coming. We're redoing and taking the last nerve to the next level, Rachel McKibbins and I. The next version of this tour is going to include that very topic of where self-defense begins way before the moment of having to physically defend yourself. And we're going to be including men in the show and in the conversation, and because this is not just a conversation amongst women.
It should include men, because they'll
Absolutely.
Tell. But men
it
spend so much time
men.
Telling us who we are, who they are, but we don't
mm-hmm.
listen. We keep
mm-hmm.
rewriting what they say. They're like, he just wants this, and we're like, no, we don't understand. You know. We need to start
so
listening to what men are telling us.
Yes. We need to have our eyes wide open and be present and not go, oh, he didn't mean that. He's not. That can't
you
be real.
You don't understand. He really cares. He's just upset right now. You don't understand. Mm-hmm. Oh, we understand.
Yeah.
We fully
right.
There's a lot of women who pick up a man like a box of Jell-O and fit him into whatever mold they're trying to make him to be.
Oh, I know it.
Oh, right? Oh.
Like a box of Jell-O. I like that.
I love that this interview is closing with Jell-O.
I love that away.
I was born in Iowa, and more Jell-O is consumed in Iowa than per capita than anywhere else in the world.
Is that a fact?
You know,
and
you,
I love that you
order,
know that.
If you order a salad in Iowa, you will probably be served Jell-O.
A Jell-O salad.
Actually, that's what their salad is. It's Jell-O with stuff in it, like carrots and marshmallows, and I don't know.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, Jell-O. Let's stop trying to treat men like Jell-O. They are not Jell-O.
When that show starts up, you have a home here to speak about it in any way that you or her or whoever you think would like to come on. Because I
Absolutely.
Love all these
would
topics.
Love to.
We can
I would
explore
love
whatever,
to.
Whatever y'all can imagine. I'd be happy to explore it on here.
Well, thank
fun.
You for the great work you guys are doing. And because this is it, you know, these conversations, this is it. This is where it begins, this constant conversation. Yeah.
Exactly.
Well,
you're part of the family now, so reach out anytime your schedule's clear and we'll find something to talk about.
Amen. Oh, it's so good to talk to you both. Mary, right? Mary and Nell.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
All right. Thank you so much for coming on. And the end song is a combination of a lot of different pieces you did. So everybody enjoy and tell us your website again.
My website is thecultofmindy.com. Cult, not like the horse, but like the, religious sect, thecultofmindy.com. But you can also just, you know, Google Mindy poet, feminist, you know, feminazi. I'll probably come up.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you travel safe, and thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks,
thank
Mindy.
You.
Bye-bye now. And good night, everyone.
This piece is called Kill the Messenger. And it starts with a quote by Marshall McLuhan that I'm sure many of you will be familiar with. The medium is message. And I think you'll catch on pretty quickly to the structure of the piece. One, here is the first book that taught you women and Indians were just accessories for the protagonist, barely human enough to be proper foils. An old paperback of how the West was won by that asshole Ronald Reagan prototype, Louis L'Amour. Also, a rusting pair of swinger sewing scissors. Take your time. Two, here is the silver Panasonic radio that announced the war. The first time you ever heard the emergency broadcast system croon its monotone disaster serenade for a lover other than a hurricane. Here is a framing hammer. Three. Here is the billboard on the side of a high-rise that promised you cigarettes would make you stronger. Wanted. Here is an 8.6 earthquake. Four. Here is the television set that trained your entire generation to sit still and watch. Here is an axe. Five. Here is the pamphlet handed to you by eager Christians with mullets trying to rack up saved souls like camel dollars. The illustrated pamphlet that told you any deviation from the body of Christ, that any instinct to buck the existence authorities would land you in hell permanently. Here is a box of matches that say, appropriately, we think, merci. Six. Here is the old biplane. A de Havilland tiger moth, we believe, responsible for writing Will You Marry Me Holly in the sky that Saturday at the water, the day you realized he didn't really love you and never would. Here is an M26 hand grenade. Seven. Here is the painting that made your heart want, that opened the door a crack to the humming, pulsing, pulling room of the possible. Here is 100 years of harsh sunlight. Eight. Here is the letter your father wrote and mailed you before he tried to kill himself. Here is a brass locket big enough to contain its folded legs. Here is an ocean. Nine. Here is the song that forced itself down your throat when you were at your weakest, the one that wrote you all wrong. It still throbs in you, an alarm clock grinding its gears when the dark rings. Here is your voice. When my father began selling off his thing, he put off unloading the Steinway baby grand piano as long as possible and had the decency to call me when it was time. He was practiced at postponing disaster. It was the highest ticket item he had, and I knew how badly he needed the money, so it meant something. The sign of a great piano is how quietly you can play it, is what he told me when he bought it, when he was at the summit of his happiness and self-philanthropy. He had this gleam in his eye back then when he was entertaining guests that I mistook for joy. He would brandish the glossy black back of it like a pet whale, like an endangered species he had become close friends with. He would be sure to point out where Henry Z. Steinway, great-grandson of the patriarch himself, had signed it, just inside the haughty curve of its hip. What is hubris, anyway, if not the signal of great imagination, of someone who has let the true self float up like a hot air balloon? What would you jettison to stay in the soft, bright clouds just one more day? At the time, I was still in love with my father, the way children are. The dark growth of his mistakes was what was weighing everything down now, and I wanted his weakness to bring out something gentle in me. Even though I had learned the pathétique on this piano, even though I had scaled its fingers with my fingers nearly every day for 7 years, even though I could close my eyes while seated at any table, see the keys take their positions like dancers on a chessboard and play the blank wood perfectly, I told him, "It's okay, Dad. It's just a thing." Then placed the phone back on its cradle, my eyes burning, my hands shaking, my heart hammering out the song that isn't a dirge, but how a dirge begins in the mind of the composer when she is still trying to get a handle on the shape of it, the swelling, changing shape of the loss. They say if 100 people were witnesses to the shootout, there will be 100 different versions of what happened that day. 102 if you count the shooters, which you do, and 104 if you count the guns, which you don't, not yet. If you gather all these stories and weave them together, you will come as close as you can come to seeing what God sees. But the weaving is tricky. You have to memorize the angles of sight. You have to interview each witness separately and learn their entire life story. Why did witness 35 assume the shooter, the first one, started the whole thing? Did he look like the brother she lost? Did the other shooter blink, or did she blink, when the clouds sifted and the sun flashed briefly? Each telling will be a cumulative telling of 1,000 other stories. It would be best if you could start at the beginning. Talk to the families of the witnesses in their childhood homes, their first lovers. It would be better still if you could teach them all to play the piano, record and analyze how they approach Beethoven's sonatas or the blues of Memphis Slim. The way music pours out of you, it's a form of lie detector test, if there is no such thing as lying. Time itself is another angle, distorting everything. If you want to get to the whole truth, just keep layering dimension upon dimension. Undo the tapestry when it gets tangled and start over. Use string and feathers and whatever clocks you have on hand. They say every writer has one story to tell, and they tell it over and over and over, trying to get it right. Or not right, but perfect. The way God would tell it. If God came out of the cage of your body long enough to draw breath and sing. Maybe that's why I'm still here in this growing mountain of paper, furiously taking down notes. I don't need them anymore. It's only important that I write them down because I learn through writing things down. For example, I'm writing, "Don't forget to ask the guns." Important. Now I'll remember for sure. Tomorrow morning, I'll shovel a tunnel through the stacks of pages and start to work getting the perspectives of objects. I could just start a fire. Burn the stories to create a pathway out. It would be easy. But then there would be all that smoke. It would obscure the whole scene. I might miss the final, most crucial detail, the one that ties this all together with one big bang.